The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety. This is the FlightBridge Ed Podcast, critical care and emergency medicine education for nurses and paramedics. Here's your host, Eric Bauer.
Hey everybody, Eric Beck with you. Today, I'm sitting here at AMTC and have some great people from University of Utah Health and Nate and Deb here from that area of the country. And they're gonna share with us kind of a program that they started recently, and it's called the 48-Hour Backcountry Challenge. So I wanna welcome them and have you guys introduce yourself and get into the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having us on. I'm Deb Vitta. I'm the chief flight nurse for AirMed.
And I'm Nathan Morielli. I'm the chief flight paramedic for AirMed.
Awesome, awesome. And we've been kind of bantering back and forth and kind of doing a pre-show and which one's better, who's better?
I think it's obvious. Go ahead, Nate, save me.
What?
Right. You always have the nurse medic like inner fighting, right?
Yeah, you know, nurses make mistakes. They didn't go to paramedic school, so that's
we
okay.
We let them think that. That's okay.
Yeah, I love it. Awesome. Well, like I said, so why don't you tell us a little bit about the inspiration of this program? Because I was introduced to Corey. Corey's kind of sitting over here monitoring this whole thing, and introduced to Corey through Dave Olvera, a good buddy of mine and fellow Air Methods employee and educator, and so that's kind of how this all came about, and just was pretty intrigued by what you guys had done and thought it would be a really good podcast. So could you just kind of talk about the inspiration, why you did this, and then we'll kind of get into more of the program.
Sure. So, you know, I think that two years ago, we were walking home, Nate and myself and our program manager, Frankie. We were walking back to the hotel at the end of the day, and I think this conversation came up about, you know, how we'd seen a lot of lectures by survivalists and also classes given by crash survivors, but that got us thinking, you know, we really hadn't seen an actual case study or what it looked like if you took a real flight crew and put them into the backcountry with the skills and the techniques and the equipment that they were given. And you know, we got pretty excited about it. Survival is something I'm an avid watcher and listener of. I love the subject and pretty passionate about it. And both of us, you know, just started chatting and getting super excited and ramped up about how we could do a project, you know, how that would be a really fascinating presentation, how that hadn't been done before, what we would want to see out of it. And, you know, quite literally, Frankie turned to us and said, well, you two, stop talking about it and just do it. And we said, well, is that the okay to do it? And she said, yeah. So we put in a presentation, you know, request for this AMTC. And I don't know if we were dismayed or thrilled in February when we found out that we were accepted. But, you know, that really started the lockdown of like, this is what we're doing. And, you know, we knew from the beginning that we really wanted to document it with a full camera team, and that would require a full support team. So there was a lot of planning on a weekly basis. We got together with a local search and rescue group. We included a local dispatch center. We had meetings with our aviation vendor because there's a lot of authorization that you have to get. There's a lot of planning and authorization just to be operating in certain backcountry areas if they're, you know, wilderness area.
Forest Service.
And I remember that half of Utah was burning down at the time where we were looking at fire restrictions. So that was a huge concern because I remember telling Nate, like, we've got to be able to have fire. We've got to be able to have fire.
Yeah.
So it took about 2.5 months just to really lock down a location and scout. And where I had originally planned to do this survival challenge was in the Uintas, kind of between Wyoming and Utah. There's this mountain range that I grew up backpacking in. I knew the terrain very well, but as it happened, this year was particularly wet. And so we knew right away that probably a lot of the great locations weren't going to be accessible. So, yeah, Nate, you have anything to add? I mean, it's pretty...
I don't. It just, you know, we were very excited that we were able to do something unique like this, to be honest. It's not something that we have seen anywhere, and being able to get the approval that we needed from everybody, not just the University Hospital and our program specifically, but all the way down to the Forest Service and local sheriff's agencies. It was pretty exciting.
Well, obviously the task of planning, it sounds like that was a huge task. And the thing that I loved about what you just said is that you came up with the idea and then you submitted it to AMTC and you hadn't done it yet. And that's how I am. It's like, just hang yourself out there, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And it kind of forces you to, now you got to deliver. And I think that that's really cool. I think that shows a lot.
Well, I'm not really a public speaker myself. I don't, you know, run education sessions. So I was telling Nate today, it's kind of funny that the first time that we decided to, well, I decided to make it a goal of mine because Nate's spoken a lot more, but, you know, to talk in front of a group, I do it at AMTC where maybe I should have worked up to it, you know, but
that's all
it
right.
No definitely way. Set the structure for now we're doing this and we got to get it moving and we've got deadlines now and we have to be very firm with those
yeah.
and, you know, 6 months of moving along through all that.
Well, and what makes it good is that that's something that you're passionate about. And so if you're passionate about something, you can talk forever on it and you're comfortable, right? I mean, that's your thing. Nobody else has it. So that's cool. So as far as the inspiration and the why, was there anything that led up to, you know, a scenario, something that kind of triggered this on, you know, obviously you guys came up with the idea, but was there something that happened in your normal career, your you know, on a flight that maybe made you realize that this was a needed training?
Yeah, I know myself. It definitely fits into why this is relevant to our program. I think oftentimes we go through survival trainings and, you know, we just kind of check the boxes, right? But you really want something that's specific to your environment, something that makes sense for your program. And 7 years ago, I was involved in a flight up in the Uinta Mountains. And while we were en route, the flight center came on and told us we were going to be first responders. There was no search and rescue team available to assist us. And as we were coming in, we were able to locate the patient, but ended up landing at about, well, we landed at 10,351 feet in a 407 helicopter. And the unique thing about this flight is that we had some unforecasted weather. Being in mountainous terrain, mm-hmm. the weather reporting isn't the best. So realizing we had that unforecasted weather in the distance, landing, realizing we had to move with some urgency, we actually started making some plans to stay for the night because while we were on scene, it started raining on us. Pilot came running over and he's like, you know, you guys got to get moving here or we're going to get stuck. And yeah. at that point, boy, it slows you down. It really catches you off guard in the sense of, wow, we could be stuck here at 10,000 feet, challenging terrain. We've already been told there's no search and rescue team available. And on top of that, we were going to have a patient to take care of.
Right.
So you factor that into this challenge, and man, it really crosses over. This is definitely relevant to our program because we were going to be there for a while.
Yeah, I think relevancy is a big key to this because a lot of times I think, go the direction of, you know, how likely is it that I would be in a crash? How often does that happen? I've got this little kid. I'm not going to need that resource much. It's kind of out of the corner, out of sight, out of mind. But, you know, one of the pieces that sticks out so much about this to me is for a segment of this challenge and the presentation, we recorded a recording just kind of driving home, you know, for the scenario, AirMed-4, we're going to have to land. It's this crash survival, you know, recording. And that really is powerful every single time I hear that. It really puts this, you know, makes my gut just clench because you think, well, it wasn't relevant until I was put into one of those scenarios. And then all of a sudden, what if that is me? And what if that is somebody in my program, my brother or my sister that I know? Then all of a sudden, it's the most important thing in front of you. And I think for all of us, you know, as little as that sliver seems to be, when you address that it's relevant, when you address that it's accredited, you know, that you have to have it because it's a requirement. What really comes through everything else is, are we prepared? Am I preparing the people that I send out on flights so that if they're in that small piece of the pie, have I given them the training? Because any time from that event forward is not the time to think about how to react to it. All of that happens before, and you can't really aptly focus on it once it's happened.
I was just going to say, I mean, really, we should be preparing for survival just like we prepare in aviation, just like we prepare medically for patients. Mm-hmm. You don't watch a PowerPoint on intubations and then go out and do intubations on live patients. And survival should be the same way. Pilots practice with their FAA check rides every year, auto rotations. And, you know, again, unless you get out and do some of this stuff, you're not going to be prepared, whether it's aviation, medical, or survival.
Well, I think, you know, when we first started talking before the show, you know, I brought up the whole aspect of, you know, a lot of times when you have a crash, either it's a complete, you know, everybody on board has perished, or, you know, you don't hear of many to where you have a survivor. But your scenario is, I mean, that could happen every flight, especially in certain parts of the country. You know, I know Utah, Wyoming, very mountainous, you know, very outdoorsy. Everybody loves it. I'm from Oregon originally, and it's the same way. And when you brought that up, I was part of a rescue team on a ground ambulance through AMR called the Reach and Treat Team. And it was a specific, we had a four-wheel drive ambulance, and we were trained. The training was over 2 years. In every environment, from avalanche, glacier, swift water, so everything. And we were trained to do exactly what you just did, to stay with a patient for up to 48 hours. So I think that really translates to the air medical environment. And what you just said, you land on a scene and you have unforecasted weather, and now you have a critical patient, and you're going to have to take care of yourself as a team. Mm-hmm. And that's a big deal. And I think that could really rocks of people, you know.
Well, especially, you know, survival strategies are very different than survival skills.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, one of the things that we kind of found even with our own program is there's some room to build, you know, and fill in that gap. We give, I think, our crews a pretty good basis with the actual, you know, fire building and shelter building and basics. And I know a lot of those of the programs who have CTS, the same thing. It's, you know, in a program where you can click through. And mm-hmm. so some, you know, whether that's hands-on or computer training, those things are there, but it's very easy to miss the power of a positive mental attitude or what your strategies are once you are on your own. You know, are you optimizing every team member? Are you interacting with each other? Are you communicating and doing what's effective in a critical situation like that?
Well, yeah, if you watch the, you know, I'm big into survival too, and, you know, you watch shows like Naked and Afraid.
We just did Flight Suit and Afraid.
Yeah. That's cool.
That's
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, you look at some of those guys that come in, men and women, you know, you see some of the guys that come in that are ex-Special Forces that have elite training, mm-hmm. and they get dropped in some of these places, and they will tap out. Mm-hmm. Because it is all truly about that mental, you know, how are you handling the mental side of it? But the realization is a flight team, you can't tap out, right? You got a patient on board. Mm-hmm. There's no tapping out. So I think what you said is perfect, that you have to, you know, you're not going to know how you're going to respond to those situations until you're put in those situations. That's what I learned when I went through all that training, is understanding your clothing, understanding layering, understanding if you start sweating, that's going to make you cold, right? And not letting yourself sweat. So there's so many things about your equipment and just how your body responds to things that you can't illustrate with CTS. Mm-hmm. Would you agree? Yeah, I mean, you
absolutely.
Just can't.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that as well, because, you know, taking a look back to what you just said a minute ago about crashes, it's most likely not going to be the crash that strands us
right.
in our area. Hopefully it's not, right?
Right.
It's the unforecasted weather. Maybe it's a bird strike that makes
sure.
us land. Maybe it's another mechanical failure of some sort. So mm-hmm. there's so many outside factors that pose a risk to safety of flight, and we need to be prepared in the event that we do have to stay somewhere.
Yeah, you're flying along and you have a chip light, mm-hmm. you know, and they try to burn it off and it doesn't burn off and you're over the middle of nowhere. It's not like you can just kind of divert to a little airport.
Right.
I mean, you're putting it down.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And if you're out in the middle of nowhere, the mechanic's got to get there.
Right.
So you're going to be there for a while. So yeah, yeah. I think that's
even though
cool.
they know right where you are.
Oh, they're going
to
take
their may not
time.
Be able to get to you right away, like so many of us
sure,
think. Right?
Sure,
they
sure.
think, oh, or they're tracking us yeah. with GPS tracking, and they know right where we are. Okay.
Yeah. What's
when
the
are they going to get yeah. to you? Yeah.
Well, and you know, with adequate preparation and training, where you know you can do it. And you've done it because either someone that you work with super closely has been put through a scenario like this, or you're put through a scenario like this, your frame of mind, I think, is completely different because you have that self-efficacy knowing that you can do it because of your training
yeah.
rather than, well, geez, this is the first time I've been put into this type of situation and maybe it's not a crash, but you know, your confidence level so different when you've had some level of hands-on experience versus some classroom training.
Sure, because that could be a massive distraction to your patient care. You know, if it was a patient care situation,
mm-hmm.
and ultimately that's our job. So can you kind of just illustrate for the listeners as far as what was the scene? So how did you set this up? What was the scene? How did you get the flight crews to participate in this? You know, how did you break them up in teams? Kind of paint the picture for us.
Yeah, so when we facilitated, you know, finally making an announcement and putting out, you know, a request for people that were interested, because one of the things, the premises was we wanted people that were invested in making this operation work as we were. And I think that required people that were at least interested in being engaged in it. We didn't want anybody to feel forced. So we asked for volunteers to be in the, to be participants. And then once we had a list of people, before we picked anyone, we intentionally showed up to the base before they knew that we were going to do anything or before they had any idea what was going on, and spot checked them. So we randomly showed up to, the helipad a couple times,
yeah.
to the base that they were working at before or after their shift, and recorded exactly what they had on them. And the purpose was because I think anytime you know that you're going to be in a challenge or, you know, a survival participation like this, you can tell somebody, well, I would have brought this. Well, I know it's on that date, so I'll buy a couple things and add to it. And I think there were some people that had the intention of doing that. And we wanted to eliminate that. We wanted to know, are we working with the things that they actually had every day? So that was one of our ways of kind of controlling that. Once we had that list from all of the volunteers, then we wanted to divide it up a little bit further by personality. And so we wanted to stay away from people that were friends. So we really wanted to get an accurate picture of a snapshot of any given day, since you can't pick your flight team member. You know, we wanted to realistically incorporate that into the challenge. And so we announced the participants I think a few weeks before we actually went to the site.
It was about 3 weeks before. Everybody that put in, we told them what the dates were, so they had that, so they could start talking with their family, make any adjustments, basically get it on their radar.
Sure.
But about 3 weeks out.
Yeah, and then we announced it, you know, announced the people that we had picked. At that point, we had our date late in July, I think it was the 28th, and we decided to do it halfway through one day on 48 hours, so it ran 3 days, but 48 hours over those 3 days. So
okay.
Two nights was basically what we wanted to capture. And our thought in that was, you know, the first night people get through. I think generally
yep.
you can, you know...
You can tough it out.
Yeah, you can tough it out.
And
you can,
it's just one night.
It's one
yeah.
night. I got this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And we wanted to see what it looks like when you're finally getting hungrier, when you're finally deciding that structure from the first night that you built for a shelter wasn't so comfortable. And what you do when maybe different personalities grated on each other, or mm-hmm. whether people were working together, or whether leadership roles were developing. And so that's kind of why we set the dates up the way that we did. So we had everybody report midday on the university helipad in Salt Lake, and that's kind of over on the east side of the bench, and up until that point, they still didn't know which direction they were flying. So we did another spot check and confiscated things that people tried to sneak in on their flight suit, And, you know, people were nervous, even the experienced team members, because we had two different teams, a team of experienced people that had quite extensive backcountry knowledge.
Okay.
And then we had a team of inexperienced team members. So it was a fair number of the people who tried to sneak in things and were nervous, so a certain amount of angst. But just as they got ready to load up, we gave them a scenario of an ATV rollover out west and loaded them up in the aircraft and they took off. So to further disorient them, because at this point they knew they were going west, but west for us means anything from desert, Bonneville salt flats are out that way. That's about 4,200 MSL. And then we have everything up till 12,000 feet. So pretty good mountainous terrain, tributaries, some snow peaks and rock peaks at the top. And so that was the direction they were going. And we put on the blindfolds until they were pretty near the site, started to guide them through. We had the pilot guide them through a weather diversion scenario that turned into an engine fire. And they were told that landing was imminent. And at that point, they started into a 360 recon over the LZ. We took off the blindfolds because we wanted to implement things that we would test in crew resource management. So one of the things we wanted to see was, well, what kind of things are they observing? I mean, we're always supposed to be looking out for alternate landing sites in case we have to land abruptly. And we wanted to see what they noticed. We wanted to see what their situational awareness was. And so they got onto the site, and we tested those things. We tested them on aircraft shutdown. And then we're all up on top of the hill, and we introduced them formally to the challenge and gave them a little bit more information about what they were expected to do. At that point, we put them into a series of physical exercises because we figured that, you know, while you can't physically put somebody into a real state of a survival unless you're in a state of survival, we wanted to increase their heart rate and their blood pressure to at least physically get them a little bit more into that moment, because you kind of focus and physically change. And we assigned them a minor injury. And the reason for that was because we wanted them to get thinking about what kind of factors would they have to adjust for. I mean, we stayed away from something more serious just because we wanted to focus on survival skills and not a medical scenario. Mm-hmm. But at that point, we told them they couldn't stay with the aircraft. We gave them a bag of supplies that were quote unquote scavenged, that were taken from the main engine or the main cabin. Handed it to them in a pillow bag and gave them the survival kit off the aircraft minus the spot. We took away the communications. Mm-hmm. And we stood up at the top of the hill and, you know, we looked down. There was a couple different draws you could see. Water wasn't necessarily obvious. And told them that it was left up to them to decide which direction they were going to go, and told them that they needed to find water and purify water, and that we would give them potable water once they demonstrated they could find the water, purify it, and make a resource to continuously purify it. So we didn't want them to drink actual mountain water.
Especially out of some of the canisters they found
there.
They were finding empty cans, beer bottles, which is great, right?
Yeah.
They found all these things, but we didn't want them actually drinking the stuff.
Yeah, that was part of the support stuff. I mean, we really had to stay away from things that would get people into a serious scenario on that was a little too real for what we were trying to do. So, yeah, we had pre-scouted this location a few times a few months earlier so that we knew exactly where the water sources were. We had reassessed it later in the summer as things started to dry up so that we still knew that there was water where we thought there was water. We had put up a drone and launched it to look at the site so we knew exactly how far the camps were away from each other, that they wouldn't make contact. We had LZs set out and alternate LZs. But, you know, the fact of the matter is we didn't know exactly which direction they were going to head. So that was kind of cool for us because, you know, that was a little bit of the unknown. And we had a very mobile camera crew to follow them through the bushes.
So how many crews did you do at one time?
So
yeah, two crews at one time.
Two crews at one
time. So one experienced, one inexperienced, a crew of three on each. So pilot, nurse, and paramedic on each crew.
So tell me how it went. How'd it go? How'd the crews do?
They did really, really good.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that we found was that eventually both crews covered the same ground. And what I mean by that is when you listen to the coverage and the experience teams talking about tributaries and water sources and resources, the caliber of what they know is obvious. But at the same time, the inexperienced team really talked through with good communication. They capitalized on each other's strengths. They decided as a group all of their decisions. And so although you see differences with things like the shelter and how much improvement needed to be done by the experienced versus the inexperienced team, mm-hmm. They really ended up covering the same ground and becoming very successful as teams all the way through. I think one of the other things is they tried to stay away from using the survival kit. It was kind of nice to see that they really wanted to see if what they brought on them was adequate and to use the survival kit as a backup. But they really flourished, I think. And because of that, you know, we wanted to see how they would do when they didn't flourish. So we intentionally gave them a challenge with a bow drill to do a fire starting challenge.
Oh, wow.
And
it's
a hard enough skill when you actually know how to do it that the person that gave them their bow drill had actually stood down in base camp and started a fire with the bow drill to make sure that we could say, no, this actually started a fire earlier.
Yeah.
It's that hard. It's really, you know, it's a tough challenge. And so we gave it to the crews because we wanted to see when everything else is going well for you and you're communicating and kind of flourishing through the rest of the experience, how do you handle it when you're not? And it was pretty interesting to see the different outcomes because the experienced team actually probably got a little bit more frustrated in not being able to start it. But the cool thing about that is as a team, they talked through what their priorities were and basically determined, you know, we have other pressing things and we should really be reinforcing our shelter. We should be, you know, stocking up on our resources, get firewood. So that was kind of cool. That's a very educated way of looking at it.
Yeah.
You know, when you're not successful, move on. And at the same time, the inexperienced team actually, I think because people assumed that they didn't know how to do it, they talked it through, the communication was excellent, and they actually busted a coal. And I love saying that, but they started a fire. They actually were successful at the challenge, which we did not expect to see.
Yeah.
And the really cool thing I think about all of that, and Nate, you know, can chime in too, but when we looked at the footage and how people did, one of the things that stood out, at least to me, that I don't think stood out as much as it did until I kind of watched over things a couple times, was it really hit me that, you know, as EMS providers, that's kind of what we do. Like, we're set up to be better survivalists, I think, because we migrate to careers where we want to deal with unexpected
yeah.
situations. Like, in our training, whether it's survival focused or not, we're learning to capitalize on each other's strengths automatically. We learn to talk to each other, we learn to communicate, and we actually seek out career choices that take us to elements of unknown experience. And I really like that because I think that that puts us in a better advantage to survive than the average person.
No, I think that's absolutely true. And I love that, you know, what you said about the experienced crew, you know, they become frustrated. Well, it's because of their experience. You know, they probably mm-hmm. thought, well, why aren't we being successful? We have experience in this. So I think it shows that, you know, that learning of the inexperienced crew and just communication and how valuable that is and working together, I think that's awesome. Was there anything that you saw that you didn't expect? Like, how did the nights go? How did the shelters go? Did they get cold? I mean, how did they deal with that?
Yeah, so great questions. Specifically about the shelters, and this is where I think we first noticed the difference between the two teams. The inexperienced team, there was a little bit of rain, so the first thing they did is grab a blanket that we gave them, and they hung it between some trees and cleared out the rocks, and that was like, hey, we're out of the rain. This is our shelter. And that's what they used for their first night. And you hear them afterwards in video saying, we paid for that. It was freezing because they had the wind coming right down the canyon, right through their camp, basically.
Yeah.
Whereas the experience team actually set up a great shelter. They had it enclosed on three sides. They had a fire pit out in front. And they ended up only having kind of a small section that they got wind through on that first night. But like we were just talking about previously, their priority that next day was, we had a small spot in the shelter that wasn't perfect. We need to fix this so we can sleep better tonight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did the experienced crew try to find the middle of the canyon, as far as that's always the warmest spot? You know, if you had a hillside, did they try to navigate towards that area?
Yeah, they did. And that's where really the difference in watching the two teams was so obvious and was cool, because the experienced team did a lot more scouting and recon. They rated the locations from 1 to 5 on potential camping spots. They really looked at the directional, the north, south, east, west, and talked about what kind of resources they had and what kind of shelter source would be the best and why. And, you know, their knowledge was obviously a lot more extensive than what the inexperienced team talked about. But they factored in direction. They factored in being close to water versus being more comfortable on the ground, and what type of fill to put in the flooring versus, you know, how to bow over the trees. And yeah, very, very noticeably different.
Did you put them specifically on the north face of the mountain, or did you even worry about that as far as when you picked the location? Or did they choose to go to the south face where it's going to be warmer, more sunlight, things like that?
I think that if I remember, they picked the location based off where they thought the water was. I think that okay. more directed which direction they went.
Right.
But we put them as on top of a precipice, especially the experienced team, on top of a precipice as we possibly could, because they were looking down into a north draw, south draw, and then out towards a valley.
Awesome.
And I wanted to see what they would do. I mean, we had scouted where the water was going to be, but I was a little nervous. I mean, we had a backup plan for how we would access any potential mm-hmm. place that they got, but it would have been considerably more difficult for them had they chosen to walk off to the north, because there was no water. And, yeah. You know, they definitely worked through the being able to discern where they thought the water guesses were and what the land looked like and the terrain association and trees and, you know, and thank goodness, because if their skills hadn't have been that good, they definitely could have walked off the wrong direction.
And how did they find their direction? Did they utilize just, sunlight? Did they take anything from the aircraft? Did they look at the trees, the terrain, you know, how dry something is? I mean, what did they use?
They talked a lot mm-hmm. about what potentially they would have taken. They had very good dialogue before they ever left the hill. They talked about what their injuries, how that would factor in. They talked about things like what they would have taken off the aircraft had we let them take pieces off the aircraft. Because we chose what they got off the aircraft and put it in a pillow sack. Mm-hmm. But they talked about what they would have taken. They talked about the potential benefits and cons to heading each direction. So the dialogue was very good about really going through all the steps and agreeing on things and the whys and hows they were approaching before they ever stepped off the hill, which I thought was pretty awesome. Impressive, because I don't remember mm-hmm. that as much from the inexperienced team.
And then how did they do on the food? What would they do there?
The experienced team, they made a deadfall trap. It was pretty impressive. But nobody really, you know, I think people had more strategies about what hunger would look like.
Yeah.
They did pop a couple grasshoppers in their mouth. On the inexperienced team, Tiffany had a couple like energy bars or something.
Yeah, a couple protein bars in her personal survival kit. Mm-hmm. That she shared with the team.
They split those up and rationed those, I think, over the first night. But mm-hmm. they talked more about food. And although I was nice enough to find and give them a snake, I don't think that anyone was desperate enough to cook it.
Yeah, I don't think they appreciated your efforts.
No, they didn't. But that was on the first day. I really think that they would have reconsidered by the end of the second day, because people were significantly more hungry.
Yeah, so at the second day, was there a big difference in morale, or did they stay pretty positive throughout the entire
military exercises or being stuck up on a rock. So Chris, who was our nurse on the experience team, he does quite a bit of backcountry climbing and rock climbing. And he had been on a bivvy a couple times where they ran out of food. And so they were used to that. And so yeah. I don't think that was surprising to them.
Right. I think it'd be interesting to do that and, you know, tell them you could be out there 2 days or you could be out there 5 days and don't tell them mm-hmm. and see if they make different decisions as far as food goes. Because, I mean, that's a big difference in mindset. Of, mm-hmm. I think we could all think, all right, 2 days. I mean, yeah, it's gonna be terrible, but 5 days is a big difference, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We actually joked with them on the last day. We yeah. thought it was funny. I don't yeah. think they thought it was, but just, hey, we've talked to all your spouses. They, yeah. You're allowed to stay back out here for another couple of days. And Chris, the one she was talking about, was like, hey, sounds good.
Yeah, I got to get off a shift if you'll just arrange that.
Yeah, he was worried about his shift.
Yeah, so he's like, ooh, this yeah. is fun.
But
yeah.
there was a couple of people that were like, I'm going to be
yeah,
done.
No, I'm leaving. Done. I'm leaving.
Yeah, cool. So I guess where do you guys go from here? Like, how can you build on this? What are your plans for the future?
Well, as a result of this, we're making some changes within our program. With any good exercise comes opportunities for improvement.
Yeah.
And Deb and I saw some when we were on the mountain, and the participants had some suggestions for us as well. So as it relates to our aircraft survival kit, we're adding water tablets and fishing line to it. The water tablets for obvious reason, and the fishing line because it has many uses outside of its intended purpose in mm-hmm. survival. You can use it to help support shelter, food preservation, first aid. There's a handful of other things you can use it for. So we're adding those two things to our survival kit, and we're also incorporating the participants into our upcoming new hire orientation as well as our upcoming winter survival training. We want them to share their experience, and hopefully some people can gain some valuable knowledge from them. Everybody that went through it actually made some changes to their personal survival kit. some people more than others, but everybody got something out of it, and we really feel like it's going to be a benefit to the new hires, get them started off on the right foot thinking about survival, as well as our other almost 100 flight team members. It's going to be some great information from them as well.
Yeah, I think the great thing is people came back having said, hey, I'm talking about this. Mm-hmm. Hey, that got me thinking. I'm changing this. I watched the so-and-so go through that, or they came back and told me what they went through, and I really feel the need to assess what I bring. And that's what we wanted. We wanted to start dialogue about really, you know, quality over quantity, you know, and is it more about what you're carrying in your brain and your positive mental attitude and your, you know, the survival strategies that you know, or is it more, you know, streamlining the equipment that you carry? Is it the effectiveness of the tools you have? Let's think about that. Let's talk about that. You know, let's get rid of things we don't need and teach things that we do and find a way to share that knowledge more efficiently because, you know, it's not fiscally possible, I don't think, for programs to put every single person through a challenge like this. Right. It's costly and to a certain mm-hmm. degree. And, you know, although we were lucky enough to have supporting agencies that we work with pool their resources with our resources and get a small grant to try to do the filming, it's, you know, it does take some pretty strict budgeting and planning, but what you can do is put some people through that more often and share the benefit of the knowledge that they reap. Have them report back, get, you know, mm-hmm. get dialogue going in your program to ask yourself, is what we're teaching relevant to our program? And, you know, do we need to shift that a little bit or is it too general? And so, you know, it's easy to streamline those things. And, you know, so hopefully that's the change that we start.
Is there any plan to maybe add a patient scenario to that to where, you know, you'd probably have to get somebody to volunteer, but like a real patient scenario where they are.
I have all kinds of ideas. Honestly, I could
been brainstorming again.
Spectrum to
yeah.
it.
You could make this episodic. Now, I mean, I think that there is some value actually in what you said. I think that there, now that we have sort of set the groundwork
yeah.
for this kind of scenario within Air Medical, And I say that because I'm not aware that it's been done up until this point, which is why I was so thrilled about being a part of sort of establishing that. That being said, I think that there is a lot of places that you go with medical scenarios. I think that there's a way to turn up the ante in the actual survival scenario with winter. You can shift the dates just slightly to spring or fall and get a whole different set of challenges out of that. A whole bunch of, you know, terrain issues and temperature issues, and you can incorporate whatever level of skill you want to test. You know, the important thing that we found is that we had to have an incident action plan. And so whatever, wherever you want to take that, whatever season or however intense you want to make the challenge, what we found is, you know, we were very grateful that from the very beginning we put a robust incident action plan model into place. And we had that plan to fall back on, because what you will find with this kind of scenario is that you're going to run into a lot of hurdles that you maybe, some of which you anticipate, a lot that you don't anticipate, and it's an ever-moving, ever-evolving thing, made more complex by the fact that, you know, if you're trying to document it, that piece is moving, and the access to the sites, and even weather affected one of our LZs. So backup plans and medical support and base camp support, you know, all of those elements, as long as they're well planned out and you have that plan in place, I think you can take the actual challenge to any direction or intensity you want. So I have mm-hmm. ideas, you know, I think that I've already talked to a couple different agencies about, you know, ideas for putting this into a winter survival. But, you know, again, that goes back to getting the authorization and the funding. Mm-hmm. And so all those things are things that I hope and intend to talk about. And, you know, I'm going to drag Nate along because he's been a perfect partner on doing this. And I've been so lucky to have somebody that, you know, I work well with on this. But yeah, I think that there's all kinds of possibilities, but nothing set in stone right now.
Well, very cool. Was there anything else that you can think of that we didn't kind of hit on? I mean, I think that we this is a pretty neat thing. Like, I want to come do it.
I mean, I'll
be there.
It's funny because we actually have a lot of people within our program now saying, when are you going to do this again? We should do this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When are we going to do a winter survival? Oh. And it's like Deb said, I mean, just the dialogue that's been created alone from this has been invaluable for our program.
Sure.
It really has.
And that's the most important thing.
Absolutely. We're affecting positive change.
We're hoping to submit for a presentation next year where we can talk more about the planning, because that's a whole other subject beyond what we talked about, you know, this time. But, you know, there, for more information on what we've done, we created a Survive This Challenge website that you can go to. One of the questions that we didn't really talk about here but has come to us a lot was, what did your participants have on them? What did you give them off the aircraft? And so we created that website, so there's extra footage and those kind of lists, and, you know, there'll be contact information. So, mm-hmm. that, you know, if people out there want to know how we did it or want some input or have great ideas, you know, by all means, we'd love to have you contact us, because we're excited to go further with it.
So do you want to share your email addresses and what that website is?
Yeah, it's survivethischallenge.com.
Okay.
Is what it is. Mm-hmm. And I believe if it's not, we will put our email addresses on there for people to be able to get a hold of us.
Okay. Awesome. Well, I really appreciate you guys taking the time out of, you know, day one of the AMTC, I guess. Obviously, you had the pre-conference. Really appreciate Corey sitting over here on the side.
Thank you so much for having
us all
on.
Together. I guarantee the listeners are going to love to hear this. So on behalf of Nate and Deb and Corey, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been a production of the Flight Bridge Ed Podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.